You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
And we're joined here again with Alan Blackman. How's it going, Alan?
G'day,
for Dear
Adam.
Science?
Yep, very well, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it's good to see you. So, it turns out butter isn't the bad guy after all, and margarine's actually the terrible one.
Well, this is kind of interesting. I guess anybody who's read the Herald in the past couple of days will have seen a story sort of extolling the virtues of butter and saying that margarine has been found to be bad for you. And it's all to do with these saturated fats and unsaturated fats and trans fats and all that sort of stuff. And it all sort of hails from about the 1950s, apparently, when the first link or supposed link between saturated fats and poor health, poor cardiac health, was made in a study. And then because of that, people all around the world, all the doctors, all the nutritionists and everything said, cut back on all of these sorts of things, all your dairy products, all your milks and your butters and your you know, your meats, etc., etc., because they're bad for you because they contain lots of saturated fats. So what the author of that study didn't say was that they were studying about 22 countries around the world. They took the data from 6 countries that agreed with their sort of hypothesis.
Oh, right. Very, very selective
data mining, yes. Yeah. And so they just got rid of all the data that didn't agree with their results, apparently, the other 16 countries. Apparently, when you include all of the data, then the effect disappears. So apparently, saturated fats are not that bad for you. So people have been laying off the butter and stuff like that.
Yeah, because I remember growing up always being told that butter was the devil, effectively. You know, you've got to stay away from that nasty milk solid.
Yes, yeah. Well, seemingly not. Well, what these guys have done, these guys in Canada, they've undertaken a study, and they didn't do any of the actual work themselves. What they did was they looked at all of the other studies that have been done since the year dot on the relationship between saturated fats and heart health, and on these trans fats and heart health. So they got all of that. They then reanalyzed all of the data. So we're talking sort of a cohort of a few hundred thousand people over the years. And they basically found that there wasn't really any correlation between poor health, diabetes, heart disease, all that sort of stuff, and saturated fats. But they did find a 34% increase in death rates from trans fats, apparently.
Oh.
So trans
That's
fats,
a nice thing to know.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
And trans fats comes from palm oil. They come from palm oil, and they're primarily used to make margarine and sort of snack foods and stuff like that. So there does appear to be some sort of correlation there. And so seemingly now the warning is, don't sort of go too heavy on the margarine because of these trans fats, and they do seem to be not very good for you.
Right.
Now, the interesting thing about all this, and as I said, if you've been this was in the Herald, I think, either yesterday or the day before, and it's sort of being presented as a big news story, but on having a look at the original paper on which this is based, it was actually published in 2015.
Oh,
so this is
okay.
2 years ago. So this is actually old news. So I don't quite know why this has been recycled at this particular time. Maybe a slow news day or something like
maybe,
that.
Not
sure.
So what exactly is the difference between a trans fat and a saturated fat?
I knew you were going to ask that. Okay, who knows any chemistry, folks?
No.
Okay, we have these little things called double bonds in molecules. What's the best way to describe this? Saturated fats don't have any double bonds, basically. So think of to make a saturated fat into an unsaturated fat, you treat it with hydrogen.
Okay.
Basically. Okay. Saturated fats have got unsaturated fats have got particular shapes, which means they don't necessarily pack well together.
Okay. Right.
And you've got these two possible things. You've got trans fats and you've got cis fats. And trans fats tend to be solids because they can pack together well, and the cis ones tend to be liquids because they can't. So things like olive oil that have got these cis linkages in them, which is the opposite of trans, they're good for you.
Right.
Okay. The trans ones, because they can all sort of pack together and they're solids at room temperature rather than being liquids, they're the bad ones.
So they effectively just stick inside of you almost.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yep.
So Your cis and your trans fats have got double bonds, and your saturated fats don't. So they treat all the double bonds with hydrogen. They actually do that on an industrial scale, and that turns your unsaturated fats into saturated fats. And as I say, you know, the thinking was that these saturated fats weren't great for you, but now, woof, go
so
crazy.
All switch around. So up next, it looks like that new developments in saltwater filtration have come about. Using a type of carbon. Am I right? And it's carbon?
It is not a type of carbon. It is carbon.
It is carbon.
It is
right.
Carbon. Okay.
Yeah. Would you better explain more of this?
I can certainly try. So one of the big problems facing the world in the future is access to clean drinking water. And particularly in the more arid regions of the planet where they don't get any rainfall, they have to somehow treat seawater in order to make it potable. Otherwise, they just ain't going to be able to survive there. And so in certainly the Middle East and certainly in Australia as well, there are desalination plants that have been set up, and they provide an enormous percentage of the drinking water, the daily drinking water, certainly in the Middle East anyway, and to a lesser extent in Australia. And so these work basically by passing seawater under pressure through a thing called a semi-permeable membrane.
Okay. Like a cell, effectively.
Like a cell, like a big sheet, basically.
Okay.
If you want to think of it something like that, okay.
Yeah.
And this membrane, you pressurize the water through it, basically. And what happens is that the water goes through, but the salt stays on the other side.
Okay.
Now, the way that these work, you do get a lot of salt residues and stuff that you've then got to get rid of. You've got, you know, enormous amounts of salt that we're talking about.
I'd imagine.
You've then got to get rid of that, and so they've got to go and dump it out in the ocean. And then there's people thinking, well, shit, you can't really do that because that's going to interfere with the sea life, et cetera, putting these enormous amounts of salt into the ocean. So people are looking for a new way, I guess, of actually doing this. And so these guys have come up with a way of using a thing called graphene oxide. And graphene sounds a little bit like graphite, which is the stuff that you get in your pencil.
Yeah.
Okay. And the way you make graphene from graphite is you get a piece of sticky tape, and you put it on your graphite and you just peel it off.
Really?
And
that
gives you a single layer of graphite, essentially, because graphite is a layered compound. It's just carbon atoms and in layers. And somebody won the Nobel Prize for that, for doing just that, taking a piece of sticky tape, putting it on graphite and peeling these layers of graphene off. And graphene's got really unusual properties. It's a really remarkable material. Graphene oxide, you make that by just taking graphene and leaving it out in the air, and it oxidizes, et cetera, et cetera. But what these guys have found is that if you take sheets now of graphene oxide and put them really close together and basically sort of hold them apart using epoxy resin, sort of glue, and you can hold them apart at a particular distance, which is very, very small. We're talking nanometers here. And what they've found is that if you pass salt water through that now, the water goes through because it's really kind of slippery inside, so the water really likes it, goes through really fast. But all your salt ions, your sodium ions, your chloride ions, all of that sort of stuff, they're too big and they can't actually get through the gap. So this thing, by the look of it, you don't have to exert the same sort of pressures that they do in sort of current desalination techniques.
Right.
Of course, they've only done this on a very, very small scale. It's a preliminary thing. It was published this week, I think, in Nature Nanotechnology, the journal. And so obviously, as they say in this, that there's a lot more work needing to be done. We've got to scale it up, et cetera, et cetera. But it's proof of principle and it's kind of cool, you know. So it could, and, you know, graphene is a relatively cheapish material.
I've heard it's kind of a wonder material. As in, you could create space elevators and things like this out of it. It's a superconductor.
They said that about things called buckyballs, which I don't know if you've heard of, Buckminster fullerene. That was another form of carbon that they discovered in about the late 1980s, early 1990s. And that was going to, it looks like a soccer ball.
Okay.
So it's these carbon with arranged like a soccer ball with alternating hexagons and pentagons. And that was going to save the world as well. So, and again, the guys who made that got the Nobel Prize as well. So it hasn't quite panned out as such
yet. Yeah, we're not seeing space elevators being built anytime soon.
We're not seeing space elevators. And I remember they were talking about them probably about 20-odd years ago. They just put them up there and they just pull them up on these big, long sheets of carbon. But hasn't happened yet.
Okay. So... I hear that the best job in the world is currently going, where you can effectively lie down on the job.
Absolutely. Yep. Who's up for being paid 16,000 euros for 2 months' work?
Yep. I've got to raise my hand for that.
Okay, and all you have to do is stay in bed for 2 months
with
at least one shoulder on the bed.
That's with at least one shoulder on the bed.
One shoulder on the bed. That's the proviso.
Is it like a big comfy bed? Or?
Well, I think it'd be pretty uncomfortable after 2 months. Probably.
I'd imagine. Yeah. I'd imagine.
So, for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, the French science aerospace science network are looking at the effects of microgravity or prolonged microgravity on the human being, basically. So, the way that they're going to do this is basically get some folk to lie in a bed for 2 months, doing absolutely everything, eating, drinking, and all the rest, in a bed. You've got to keep your head inclined at a particular angle or something, apparently. And so they're looking for 25, I believe, male volunteers, and you've got to be aged between, I think, 22 and 45. You've got to have a BMI of between 22 and 27. No smokers need apply. And then once they sort you out and make sure you're all fit and healthy and everything like that, they undergo a battery of tests for a couple of weeks. Then you're in the bed for two solid months, 60 days. And then at the end of that, it's another 2 weeks tests and to see how you've coped with the apparent effects of microgravity. Apparently staying in bed for 2 months is the same sort of thing as experiencing.
Yeah, that's what I was about to question. You know, I would have thought there'd be a vast difference between kind of floating and lying in bed.
I would have thought so too, but you know, these guys know what they're doing, I'm sure.
Effectively. So what exactly do the effects of microgravity tend to have on people? What are they trying to find out?
Well, they're trying to see if they can alleviate sort of things like people get lower bone density, muscle wasting, all of that sort of stuff happens when these guys go up in space. So just because you're not using, you know, your muscles and bones, etc., like you normally would in gravity. So the whole point of this apparently is trying to see if they can somehow sort out how to get over these sorts of problems, which are going to be problems for any sort of prolonged space mission or whatever. Apparently, at the end of sort of a decent amount of time, people can't walk. You know, they'll sort of learn to walk again after they've been in space for a while. And so it's all of that stuff. 16,000 euro for 2 months in bed.
I don't know. Yeah, it sounded promising to start with, but the whole one shoulder always lying down doesn't sound very comfortable after a while.
Yeah. Bed sores.
Yeah. Not good. Not good.
No.
Well, thank you again, Alan.
We'll see you
again next week.
Okay, shall do. See
you. Cheers.
Ya.
That was Dear Science.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.